everybody for showing up at this fine hour. I didn't want to interrupt the general. I know that seals can hurt you. Anyway, to get things started, what I'd like to do is go ahead and start with HB 53, which deals with an act establishing the Alaska Seismic Hazards Safety Commission. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair.
Now, Mr. Chair, before we get started, I'd move that we adopt the CS 32401 Lauterbach purposes of discussion, if that's what the sponsor is intending
That's
on
fine
discussing.
With me. Fine with me. Mr. Chair, I can, let me just, I'll introduce the, well, do you want to, how do you want to do it?
I guess we'll move it.
Okay.
Seeing no objections.
I'll give a very brief introduction to what the bill does, and then I'll tell you also quickly what change we made with the CS from the original bill. It's a auspicious day to talk about this bill.
John, before I let you go farther, I guess we have to do a roll call.
No.
Let's see who all is here. For the record, we have Representative Hayes, Representative Green, Representative Cisna, Representative Cott, and Representative Chenault. Also in the audience, we have Carol Carroll, General Oates, Commissioner Duncan, and Pat. Brothers?
Yes.
Okay. I'm not real good with names, Pat, so I'll work on that.
Next Marine, by the way.
Yes.
That's right. Thanks, seals are bad.
We also have Sheldon Winters online, who will speak on HB 53, and also Carol Carroll will testify. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, thank you. Well, I just wanted to note that by setting off the date when we heard the bill, we've come on an auspicious date, which is the 45th anniversary, the Good Friday earthquake. And I stole off off the wall. David, maybe you could hold that up so you can see it. The newspaper article that we've got up in the halls here about the 1964 earthquake was the second largest earthquake that we've recorded in history. It was recalculated in the 70s as a magnitude 9.2 event. The largest one that we know about was a 1960 event in Chile that was a 9.5. So Alaska has some dubious honors in that regard. And we, you know, they talk about California being earthquake country. Well, there are more earthquakes per day of a given magnitude in Alaska than there are in California. We're on one of the major plate boundaries, of course, the collision boundary between the Pacific plate and the North American plate, and it generates a great number of earthquakes, not only along that plate boundary, and there's a plate boundary that extends along southeast, which is similar to the San Andreas Fault, and then the underthrust boundary that caused the Good Friday earthquake. But also, it generates a lot of stress in interior Alaska. So we have a good number of earthquakes in the Fairbanks area. And over the course of the recorded history in Alaska, we've recorded 5, maybe 7 or larger earthquakes north of the Alaska Range. So the entire state is subject to some earthquake activity. And it's important that we understand and can build buildings do zoning to account for the occurrence of those earthquakes. What this bill would do is create a seismic hazard safety commission, and that commission would be sited in the governor's office, would be kind of an umbrella, have an umbrella status over the various agencies. The intent would be to have a body where we could coordinate seismic hazard mitigation policy for the entire state. We have a number of agencies that deal with various aspects of this right now. The agency that probably deals with, two agencies that deal with it a lot. One is the Division of Emergency Services in DMVA. DES does a lot of work mostly on preparedness, that is being ready to respond when the event happens, dealing with the disruptions, getting power systems back online, and doing that, making sure that people are safe. The Geological Survey, the Alaska Division of Geology and Geophysical Surveys in DNR, does a lot of work on basic data, on helping to run the seismic networks and understanding the history of occurrence of earthquakes. But we don't have an agency that at the state level that's really focused on how can we reduce the effects of earthquakes. We know that they will occur. And the primary way, of course, that we respond to the fact that earthquakes will occur is through building codes. And as you know, when we have a magnitude 6 earthquake in the United States, there's some damage, but it's not a big deal. If you have a magnitude 6 earthquake in some of the third world areas of the world, it can be a major disaster. It can be tens of thousands of people's lives lost. And the reason for that is building codes or lack of them. If you build unreinforced masonry, you can be sure that building won't withstand a magnitude 6.5 earthquake. We enjoy some of the best designed buildings in the world, but we can do better. One of the things that we saw during the recent earthquake that occurred in Seattle, or south of Seattle, they're calling the Nisqually earthquake, was that the damage was less than they expected there, because it was a deeper earthquake for that magnitude. It was a deeper earthquake. It didn't cause the intense shaking or the duration of shaking, or had the same number of aftershocks that you might expect from a shallower event. But it still caused billions of dollars of damage. That's with a B, billions. Mm-hmm. So it's a big thing that we need to prepare for them. Most of the earthquake damage that occurs in moderate to large size earthquakes is about 80 to 90% is actually cosmetic damage. It's not damage that results from a building falling down, but from things like light fixtures falling down, those kinds of things. So we can do a lot to reduce the losses. What this commission would do would be to survey what we're doing in Alaska, to stay up to date with the most modern changes that we can make in building codes, and make recommendations to the executive branch, to the legislative branch, and to the various agencies as to what we can do to improve the situation. So without going much farther into it than that, I think I'll leave it at that. The commission is recommended here to be composed of 9 members, and the CS changed. We used to have at line 19, we had 4 members from the public. We changed that to 3, and on line 18 added a representative of the insurance industry. I thought there was some members of the insurance industry talked to me about that. I think that's a really good idea, because a lot of the issues around responding to an earthquake and damage that occurs in earthquakes, of course, impacts the insurance industry a great deal. In fact, the reinsurance industry employs some of the best seismologists in the world, because it is one of the major disasters that could impact them on a global basis, and they simply don't want to be caught in a position where they're going to where they would go bankrupt. So they have to understand what the nature of their exposure is. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll quit. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. I understand we do have a few people on mine. Be happy to hear the other testimony.
Any questions? Representative Green.
Thank you. Actually, just a kind of a quickies. Is it true that roughly, I know it's not exact, but roughly every full number of increase of magnitude is about a tenfold increase from the prior number? In other words, from going from 5 to 6 is about 10 times as much as a 5, and a 7 is about 10 times as strong as a 6. I know that doesn't perfectly, but about roughly.
Yeah, the magnitude scale is an open-ended logarithmic scale. And so, but the factor of 10 refers to the amplitude of the wave. So a magnitude 8 has a wave amplitude that's 10 times larger than magnitude 7. But that corresponds in energy to about 32 times. So if you go from a magnitude 5 to a magnitude 7, going up 2 units, you've gone up 1,000 times in energy. So it's pretty significant. So, which is one of the problems. That's one of the reasons why I think we need a seismic hazard commission, is because also with each magnitude, as you go down, they're 10 times more frequent. So there's 10 times as many fives as there are sixes, et cetera. And so the problem is that people experience earthquakes a lot, but they tend to experience small ones. And the really large ones, of course, like the 1964 earthquake, we think the recurrence interval for those earthquakes is on the order of 500 years, you know, plus or minus quite a bit. But so you're not likely to experience another one of those. On the other hand, it is likely that there'd be, in our lifetimes, probably a 7 in the Anchorage area. Could even be an 8. So we need to be ready. The problem is that, you know, very few of us actually experienced the 1964 earthquake. And we tend to have short memories, so we forget, you know, and our preparedness drops. So that's because of that logarithmic relationship, both in the frequency and the size. It's important that we do something like this so that we are prepared.
Brief follow-up. Thank you. I know that they have a situation like this in California and probably in other states, but they have an advisory group just like this. Does the fact that the state would be bringing on this advisory committee, and then the advisory committee would work in the public and private sector, both, I would think, does that in any way create any liability to the state?
I don't believe so.
Representative Murkowski.
Thank you. My cookie down. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for feeding me. I need that.
Compliments of Representative Sisna.
And
for the record, Representative Murkowski has joined us.
Thank you. Sorry, Mike. Representative Davis, right now the commission would be under the auspices of the Office of the Governor. And I guess when I read it, I made the assumption that it would be perhaps within Military and Veterans Affairs, Emergency Services, in kind of in that auspices, and that was how it got to our committee or DNR. Why Office of the Governor as opposed to any of those two?
My thinking in suggesting that was that I felt that the committee needed to have the ability to coordinate across state agencies, so that there are important issues within Department of Transportation, public facilities, with respect to the codes that we require our buildings to be built at. As you indicated, DNR does some work in terms of hazard assessment. DMVA through ADES does a huge amount of work in preparedness, some work in mitigation. But because a lot of those different effects and activities are scattered in the different agencies, I thought it was best to have it up at the governor's level so that they could coordinate across agencies. It's just a bureaucratic fact that if you have something like this in one agency, they tend then to listen to that agency, and the other agencies have a tendency to ignore it. And it's easier to coordinate across agencies if you have that position in the government's office.
And I appreciate that. It makes sense. And I had a question. In your findings, you mentioned in subsection 2 that you need to have a policy framework and means for continuing coordination of programs and public safety practices. I mean, we know that out there in many of these divisions and departments, there is a little component, whether it's emergency services or wherever it is. And I guess my question is there, I know that there isn't a commission, and there's obviously not an advisory board, but is there anything that kind of acts as an oversight? We've heard from the Director of Emergency Services, and he talks about, you know, what happens in the event of an earthquake and how they would mobilize, but I guess as I'm speaking, that perspective is just as to how do you deal with the emergency right there. And they do deal with the preparedness aspect and educating the public on that. But in terms of the other things that you look to, maybe there really, there's. I guess I want to know that there is some oversight or some coordinator, and you're telling me there's just not.
each of the agencies that deals with it does take some responsibility to try to do some coordination, but there is, the fact of the matter is that there is no focus in our state government on coordination on the issue of mitigation as opposed to preparedness. Now, like I said, each agency does address that. It's important to understand the difference between mitigation and preparedness. Mitigation is where you try to design buildings so that when an earthquake does occur, that it won't suffer as much damage. Or you try to do land use planning so that if there's an area where you expect a landslide, that you try to discourage people from building in that area. Yeah. Those are the kinds of things. That's the difference between mitigation efforts and preparedness. Preparedness is getting ready to respond to an event when it actually happens. Mitigation is to take steps ahead of time so that when the event does occur, the damage will be less. The reason I'm proposing the bill is because we don't have that. And most other states in the western U.S. and many in the eastern U.S. have established such commissions because they discovered the same thing. There wasn't a group that was focused on that issue over the long haul. And I'm not proposing, incidentally, that that this group come up with changes in the building codes and we establish them retroactively. It's obviously a lot less expensive if when you're designing a building that you incorporate the latest codes into that building. And that's the kind of thing that I have in mind. This is a long-term look at the problem. It's a seismic risk is an issue that's going to be with us for decades and centuries. And so I think it's the kind of thing that we just need to take little steps at a time as we go along.
Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My daughter, her business is in a building in Seattle that sustained earthquake damage, and I was able to go down to Seattle and actually to Olympia and that whole general area the weekend after the earthquake. So saw exactly what resulted and exactly how important their mitigation work was. In this bill, you must have, I'm assuming, looked at or maybe you didn't, what Washington State did. Is there anything in this that's different than what they did, or would this protect us further, or is this about the same kind of effort that Washington State did?
This is similar to what Washington does. We did, actually, Rod Kombelik, who's at the State Geological Survey, did some work surveying what all the other states have done, and we used that survey to design this bill. It's patterned more after, I think, the California Seismic Safety Commission. And there's, with respect to Seismic Safety Commission, some states are more sort of all hazards oriented. Some are strictly seismic. We decided in this case to stick to the seismic issue to focus it, and so that it wouldn't get too big and cumbersome. You'll find those kinds of variations in other states. That's the primary difference between this and some of the other states where they may include volcano issues or explicitly, or other kinds like landsliding issues or wind in some states where that's an issue. Hurricanes in the West East Coast.
There's many other in Alaska that have volcano issues.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, we have a Division of Geological and Geophysical Survey, and don't they record and don't they follow either in conjunction with the Geological Survey and other services that deal with subsurface activity? Are they not prepared or capable or doing what this same commission would be doing?
They are focused mostly, the state survey right now, the work that they're doing helps to support the seismic networks that we use to monitor activity, and that those are applied to both earthquake and volcano issues. But the primary research that they're doing and have done recently has been more toward understanding what the long-term frequency of really large earthquakes like the 64 earthquake would be by doing things like it's called paleoseismicity, by doing boreholes and seeing where the peat layers are, different layers down like at near Girdwood, for example, where you can find that you can find evidence of four or five previous large earthquakes like that. And if you go down in the boreholes, and so the state surveys focus on that, but so it's basically developing the scientific information that would allow us to make public policy determinations. But they're not in a position. They're a scientific agency. They're not a policy agency, and so they're not really in a position to drive these kinds of concerns.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Thank you, Representative Davis. Also, online, we have Milton.
Wiltsey.
Milt Wiltsey, yeah.
DNR Director. You want to testify on HB 53?
Strategizing to pull the various elements that we have building new buildings and new structures. I think that the true story of their effect will never be written, because we can avoid disasters that we wouldn't otherwise step around. And so I think that this idea of having a commission dedicated to thinking about these things and guiding the state's effort is a good one. I wish that DGGS could do more. We have what I think is a very effective program, given the resources that we have to put towards it. I think that the work that Rod has been doing in coordination with the MBA and with the University of Alaska is as good as any that you'll find anywhere on the West Coast. Hopefully we have a long time to work on the mitigation side of this equation before we have to step up to responding to any event. But I think it's important that we do everything that we can out ahead of an event to try to lessen the impact of one. That concludes my remarks. I'd be glad to try to entertain any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Milton. Next online, we have Sheldon Winters with State Farm.
I'm actually here in person.
Oh, there you are. Sorry. Come on up. Always better in person.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Sheldon Winters. I'm here on behalf of State Farm Insurance Companies. I'll be very brief. I'm here for two primary reasons. One, to voice support for this legislation, and two, if there are any questions about placing a representative from the insurance industry on the membership, I can try to answer those for you. This is a great bill. State Farm is involved in earthquake mitigation throughout the country and truly works hand in hand with all the other commissions in the other states. And I'm told, at least, that they think that the state commissions are a good thing and have worked wonders where they have been in place. So even if this bill were to pass without an insurance representative, we would support the bill. We thank Representative Davis for listening to us about some suggestions that the insurance industry representative be placed on there, and I'll be real brief on that. The insurance industry pays for a great majority of the losses, especially the residential losses, so they have a vested interest in this. They do already work hand in hand with other state commissions. They have a great expertise not only on insurance issues, but because of their involvement, they have, an ability to tap other expertise. They have a great relationship with building experts, with seismic expertise. They have involvement in catastrophic type of think tanks. So an insurance industry representative could serve as a conduit for this commission for information, and quite possibly help formulate the issues and let this commission know what other states have done and problems that have come up. So that's basically the end of my comments, unless there are questions.
Representative Murkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious to know what, from an insurance perspective, you actually do to help with the mitigation. I know that, for instance, from my home insurer, I get little flyers monthly or on an occasional basis that talk about home safety and make sure your battery is current in your smoke detector. But I'm curious to know what exactly you can do to help with that. And then the second, I live in Anchorage. I live across the street from probably one of the most photographed incidents from the 1964 earthquake, where Government Hill School slid down the bluff and just dissolved. And I'm told that my house, however, is on bedrock and isn't going anywhere. But as far as earthquake insurance goes, and I have to admit I'm a little bit in the dark about this, because quite honestly my husband works with our insurance agent, but I understand that we do not have earthquake insurance, and earthquake insurance is pretty much prohibitively expensive in Anchorage. And can you comment on that?
I'll try. I'm not truly an insurance expert nor an earthquake expert, but I think that the most obvious way the insurance company is involved in mitigation is, for example, dealing with what type of building codes can be in place, both for residents and commercial buildings. I can only speak in generalities above that. I am told that with respect to the other state commissions, the insurance industry is involved and can put their input, at least tap the expertise of if it's not building code people, of other seismologists or experts or architects, and they have, I guess, a real ability to tap those expertise. So that's about all I can say on that. As far as coverage, I guess the only thing I can respond to that, Representative Murkowski, is that it's those type of issues that can be addressed on this commission with an insurance representative. Those questions can come up, and some of the things that the commission can look at as in respect to mitigation, the insurance industry can then respond and say, that will work. We might be able to provide some coverage in that instance. I don't know your personal situation. I know that there are obviously places and residents that are not covered. There are also places in Alaska that are covered. I guess I would just say that having somebody on the commission can be one of the issues that can be addressed. What can we do to provide more coverage to homeowners and work that in that respect?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Carol. Carol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Carol Carroll. I'm from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And like Representative Davies did talk about, we are heavily involved, certainly, in the planning and the response to disasters. But we do believe that there is a place for bringing these issues and elevating these issues to a commission that could really develop some policies, recommendations, and kind of move us forward in a direction of mitigation. The division does do some mitigation work. We do get some mitigation money for communities when there is a disaster, but there really is more work that can be done. I want to tell you that the department does support this bill, and I'd answer any questions if I could.
Representative Murkowski.
I'll ask the same question that I asked of Representative Davies. Then it's in the Department of or Office of the Governor. Would you rather have it with Military and Veterans Affairs?
Through the chair, Representative Murkowski. There isn't any desire on the part of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to have the commission or not. In the governor's office is fine with us.
You just want the commission?
I think the commission certainly is valuable, yes.
No other questions? Thank you, Carol. With that, I don't believe there's anybody else online that wants to speak on House Bill 53. If not, I'll return it to the committee.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, then, John, I'm the CEO of a pretty good-sized corporation, and I'm going to come in and build a 28-story building in Anchorage. What would I do differently if this commission is in existence than I would be doing today if I wanted to go down and get a permit to build that building?
Virtually nothing.
How would this commission help this situation?
Hopefully what would have happened in the 10 or 15 or 30 years prior to you actually doing that and getting your building permits would be that this commission would have worked with the building officials, with a variety of experts, and would have incorporated the most current research that makes sense into the building code, so that you would just be following the building code. You may be doing some things differently within that code than you would have otherwise, but procedurally, my view is it wouldn't impact you at all. You will, you know, hopefully what will be happening is you'll be doing the most cost-effective preparation in terms of building your building, so that your insurance costs will be minimized and the probability of you suffering a major loss will be less. But
in terms of the, you know, as a CEO, in terms of the step-by-step process, is going to get this permit following this section, you know, section 23 of the Uniform Building Code for earthquake hazards and that kind of thing. You'd be doing the same things. The numbers that you're using might be slightly different. You might be required in building your building to do the detailing of the connection of a post to a beam slightly differently than you would have otherwise. Most of the time when you do that in the construction of a building, though, those kinds of changes are almost negligible in the cost. If you have to retrofit, that becomes
yeah,
more expensive. Okay. But if you do it in following the codes in up front, the cost is pretty minimal.
Just very brief. The reason I'm asking that is it may not have been code, but I know when they were building the Arco Tower, we could look out the window and watch the massive amount of rebar and concrete in the substructure. Mm-hmm. And I understand, I don't know this, but I understand that there are Teflon, there are rollers on Teflon so that it will give with the motion. Now, do you know whether that was part of the building code in Anchorage, or was that just ARCO design, and this committee would then probably come up with that kind of stuff in the future? Is that the idea?
Generally speaking, when you're building a building as big as the ARCO Towers, you hire the best seismic hazards folks you can, and you get somebody that's going to design that. And I'm not familiar with the specific detail, though many buildings these days are built with seismic shock absorbers in the foundation to attempt to decouple the shear motion from the building. It's a pretty well-proven technique.
So that this might be instituted in for X number of stories, this might be instituted in the building code as a result of this committee's work. Is that
right? Yeah, that's where I see it. It plays out over the long haul, okay. and mostly through building codes, somewhat in land use planning, but mostly in building codes is where I think the payoff will be.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. This may be a rhetorical question, but you know, we had the big quake in 64. We have quakes all the time and a lot of big ones. And why does everybody else have one of these and we don't?
Well, I think there's a certain irony in that. Most of the other states adopted their commissions in response to our earthquake. They learned the lesson.
And we just stuck our head in the sand. We're not going to have another one. We've had ours.
Try it again.
Actually, there were a lot of people that I think kind of thought that way, and there's a certain amount of truth in that, of course. I mean, there isn't going to be another big one right in Anchorage, you know, in the next 10 years, but there will be. You know, like I said, the probability of a magnitude 7 earthquake in Anchorage is significant. The probability of a magnitude 8 is not inconsequential. And the probability of a 9, you know, will rise with time. So we need to prepare for these things over the long haul. You know, there are a lot of things we can do now that will make buildings much safer and expose the building owners to a lot less potential loss if we continue to incorporate what we learned from, like the Nisqually earthquake and the Japanese earthquakes. The United States and the government of Japan are the leading agencies in the world in trying to learn the lessons from earthquakes. We don't understand everything that we should right now. It's not a science that's perfectly advanced. We certainly don't know how to predict earthquakes, but we continue to move the envelope forward in terms of what we know, and I think what we need to be doing here in Alaska is making sure that we have people that are following that discussion and are making sure that what's learned from those efforts is incorporated into our codes.
Still just surprised that we don't have one. I'm sure you saw the article about the faults that lay here in Southeast, and the message there is, if it's building anywhere, it's building along the Queen Charlotte Fault or something like that, going right up to through to Yakutat and Cordova. And a taxi cab driver in town here, I have it on reliable authority that Juneau is the next big hit. So I don't take that lightly.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Any other questions? And I'll return it to the committee for action. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that We move CS for House Bill number 53 out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Objections?
Is there a fiscal note?
Yes. Pretty good.
I know I saw it somewhere, but I didn't see it attached to the
$35,000. Seeing no objections, we'll move the bill on to, I believe, State Affairs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Information purposes, recommended dates. Now, when I went to school, and I only have a 12th grade education, so you have to bear with me. The earthquake was in 64. Today's 201. 37 years.
You might pass that.
Could I pass the equivalent exam? I doubt it. I've worked on a couple parts of it, I promise you. With that, I'm sorry it's... It took as long as it did, but what I would like to do now is move on to House Bill 88. And first on my agenda is a very sincere apology to Mr. Laddie Shaw. Laddie, I believe you're on the phone with us, is that correct?
I am, sir.
Laddie, it was not my intention last week to not let you testify. In my mind, I felt that, or I thought that you were from Juneau, so I wasn't concerned at that time about your testimony. I figured, you'd come back next week.
Well,
not a problem.
A cup of coffee I bought you.
Yeah, I know it. I know it. And I did want to say publicly that I'm truly sorry that you flew down and weren't allowed to testify. So if I guess since I'm the committee chair, I can kind of do what I want to. And what I would like to do is have you testify or give us your testimony on HB 88. I know it's been burning a hole in your pocket for the last week. And I would like to hear that, and then we'll move on to anybody else that may want to testify.
That is it true you can whip Ventura 2 out of 3 falls?
Well, I know I can run faster than that.
Well, I didn't understand who I was making mad. I do now, and I'm truly sorry.
All right, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. For the record, I'm Laddie Shaw, Director of State Veterans Affairs, Department of Military Veterans Affairs. The veterans truly need this Pioneer and Veterans Home project to move forward. We need legislative support. And to make a comparison, we do have one of the largest veterans populations in the nation. But we provide, from a state perspective, probably the smallest amount of support. We have a $540,000 budget presently that supports in excess of 60,000 veterans throughout the state. As a comparison, Mississippi, which is one of the poorest states in the nation, presently has 4 veterans homes, and they're supported with over $4 million in state general funds, supporting 600 veterans in those homes. We're trying to develop support here to support a very small population of veterans in the state, and in turn, bring to the veterans some entitlements and benefits that they so assuredly deserve. I didn't want to make this too long. I just wanted to really ask for your support in moving this forward. Next month, I'm going to Washington, D.C., and I'm going to be meeting with Secretary Mississippi. We do our annual walkthrough with the congressional delegation in April with the directors for Veterans Affairs nationwide. And I've been asked to give a report to both Secretary Mississippi and our congressional senators as well. And I would like to take to them that this bill is moving forward in a positive fashion. And that's all I have,
Walter. Thank you, Laddie. Any questions of Laddie? Seeing no questions, once again, Laddie, please accept my apologies for last week. And we won't wrestle about it, but I'll owe you something.
Thank you.
Thank you. I would guess I would open up the Is anybody else in the audience want to testify, either commissioner or general?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Major General Philip Oates, the Adjutant General for Alaska, Commander of the National Guard, and Commissioner of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And you correctly pointed out in a former testimony that the members of the committee didn't have a military crest, so I'm here bearing gifts. Rest assured that these are below the threshold that you have to report, and rest assured, regardless of how you vote, that these crests will make you firm supporters of the Alaska National Guard. I give one to Representative Murkowski, but her support is so good. She gets two.
Suck up.
Vigilance.
Thank you, General.
Thank you. For those of you that have had military service, I know Representative Green, Representative Cott, Representative Hayes, you know, understand that, you know, soldiers fight and die for each other. When the shooting and the dying happens, it's truly for your comrade that's by your side. But certainly they're inspired by these pieces of metal and pieces of cloth that mean so much. And what I'd like to do is spend a little time today to make you all feel the weight of this decision that you're making. And I'd like to say that not moving this bill forward is a vote no, and it's a vote against our. We received the flag from the Russians when we took this territory and were our first form of government. The military laid the cable, the Womcats laid the first telegraph cable between here and Washington. You know, the infrastructure itself was built up as we prepared for World War II here. The second bloodiest battle of the entire Pacific in World War II was fought here on our own soil. Now, Dutch Harbor and Attu felt a foreign invasion. Citizens gave their lives. Citizens fell out. And got their arms ready to defend their homeland here. You know, when you look at the buildup and what has happened in this state, the military is one of the biggest industries in the past and in the present for this state. One in five Alaskans has some connection with the military. They've either served in the military, they're serving in the military, they currently work in the employ in some capacity to support the military, or they're veterans. They're POWs, they're MIAs from here, and there's a very, very strong voice. I've been asked sometimes why the veterans haven't been more active in working with the legislature, although they've made this their top priority. That's because they know selfless service, and they depend on their elected representatives to do what's right for them. And that's the burden that's on this committee. And if you just let it languish here, it's a vote no against our veterans. I'd like to also paint one other picture of what we have here. I've talked in the past about the opportunity to go from the bottom of the pile to the top of the pile. You know, it's disgraceful that the state with the second highest per capita number of veterans in our nation does not have a veterans home. We've heard from our congressional delegation. We've heard from the Secretary of Veterans Affairs that we want to help, but we can't help until the state takes a move forward. And it's time to move forward. This is the biggest shortcoming and failure of my time in this office. And we owe it to the veterans to do something. And by going from the bottom of the pile to the top of the pile, let me just describe a recent meeting I had in the Anchorage Pioneer Home. We had a Dr. Cohen, who's a paratrooper in the Israeli Army, and his wife, who's also a doctor in behavioral science, who now live in the United States. And their expertise is in designing homes to help those in severe medical need in the Alzheimer's category. And what type of architecture and what kind of home do you have to help people have a quality of life later in life, whether it's a pioneer or whether it's a veteran? And if I can just paint a picture in your mind, you can picture one model, which is the medical model, where you look down something that is a very clean and pure hallway But there are people sitting in wheelchairs in despair with their, you know, they're slobbering on themselves. There's no happiness. And there's just despair there. The medical needs are met. You go into a shower facility, a latrine facility, and you see open bathtubs, row after row, and something like Representative Cott would see, you know, when he was in basic training. And that's because medically, you know, that meets the needs. But it hasn't met the human needs. Now, he contrasted that to what we have in our current Pioneer home system, which is a magnificent system. He contrasted that with talking about how we meet the needs of our, not only our veterans, but our parents when we all get to that stage of life. He showed us how you can make it meaningful and how something like a veteran's wall of honor in a section of the home or a pioneer's wall of honor can make things better. We had that kind of home system here. We've got 6 regional pioneer homes across the state. We have the opportunity to go beyond Mississippi, and God help us if we can't go beyond Mississippi with their 4 homes. We can go to 4 veterans' homes regionally where people can receive care close to their homes. They can receive the care that they earned and that we owe them, and they can receive a higher quality of care because that initial picture I painted for you were of veterans' homes. Unfortunately, if we go and build a veterans' home, it will have fewer beds, and it will cost us more money, and it'll be that first picture, not the last picture that I gave you. So when you think about what you owe to the veterans, I would ask you to think of what they've done for Alaska. And if we can't, and if we say as a state, we can't afford to assist our veterans, it's not a state that I'd want to stay in as a military member. So that completes my testimony. And again, I put the burden on this committee. Because if this doesn't get out of committee, let me tell you, you've all voted no against our veterans. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Joe. Representative Murkowski.
You are just so tough. You made a point in your last testimony when you participated telephonically. And my notes say that the Alaska residency requirement, you have to be a 1-year resident in the Pioneer Home, that the residency requirement precludes us from getting federal VA money. Did I interpret it, hear that correctly?
Through the chair to Representative Murkowski, let me attempt to answer this question, and possibly Laddie Shaw can answer if I give something that's inaccurate. We have a great opportunity to receive veterans' benefits that were earned by the veterans through this system. But since it's a non-traditional veterans care system, we do not get the per diem that is available. We still have the opportunity to get things like clinical assistance and pharmacy assistance and other medical care. But as far as the per diem we get for a veteran, right now we would not get that, but we have great interest from the Secretary to make this a pilot project and actually make that per diem available. There are reasons why we don't want to initially go down the road of changing this to meet all the requirements and regulations of the veterans home system. However, I will say that Secretary Principe, when he was here, stated, and he went to 2 of our homes and has in fact visited 3 of our homes. Comparing those to the other veterans' homes, he said we compare very well. Not only do we compare well, we have a better approach to long-term care than what he sees in many of these other homes around the nation. The concern is in their regulations is to make sure we meet basic needs like fire protection, health and sanitation and safety, and handicapped access. I think I'm quite confident after visiting the homes myself that when we have those visits and when the state makes a commitment to go forward and the federal VA comes down, I think you will see us, my prediction is, get those federal VA benefits for those residents. Now, we don't have that yet, but again, we won't get anything until we take the first step forward. And I said to this committee the last time, this is the best idea we can come up with. if this isn't acceptable, I'd sure like some help coming up with another idea.
And if I can just follow up on that, just to make sure then. So right now, the hitch in getting federal money is because the Pioneer Homes are not it's a non-traditional facility, to use your words, but it isn't necessarily tied in to the residency requirement that you have to be a one-year resident of a Pioneer Home.
Through the chair to Representative Murkowski, no, that is correct to my understanding. Laddie, I'll ask you if you've got anything to add.
Yes, General. Through the chair, Senator Murkowski, Representative Murkowski. There are no requirements presently within the system as it is because veterans are not acknowledged as a part of the Veterans Administration entitlement programs because they do not have their own bed space, so to speak, their own home. And if this moves forward and we do have a Pioneers and Veterans Home, then the Veterans Administration will potentially move forward those entitlements to those veterans in those beds. And those entitlements, the per diem dollar could be anywhere from $39 to $52 a day. And that's an entitlement that every veteran in every veteran's home in America presently gets.
I have one more question, and it's completely off that subject. You have stated, I think very eloquently, that we indeed owe a great debt of honor and tribute to our veterans, and I agree entirely and want to support you in this. In some of the conversations that I have had with people who are perhaps less supportive than you on this, there appears to be a concern or a fear that by doing this, by making it a veteran pioneer home or pioneer veteran home, that somehow or other we're not giving we're taking the respect that the pioneers of Alaska have earned, and that things are going to change because you've moved in. And I had a conversation with Laddie Shaw about this and said, you know, is it just the name? Are they fearful because we're changing the name, and once you change the name, everything else changes after that? And I understand that by changing the name, it says right up there publicly, Veterans Home, Veterans and Pioneers Home, and you're giving recognition and honor to that. But I guess at the end of the day, what we don't want this to just be a title. We don't want it just to be a name. We want to give them the care that they deserve. So is the name that critical? If we could have a program where our vets were incorporated into the home, as you've suggested, but just try to allay some of the, it seems like a little bit of a paranoia about changing the name and therefore you've changed the program.
Through the chair to Representative Murkowski, and I feel your concern and wanting to do something for both of these groups, which we do as well. And I'll answer the question, but first let me say that the more we go out and talk to the groups, the more their concerns are alleviated. When you get to and talk to the residents and you see how they embrace the veterans and what the veterans bring to the home themselves, I don't think you see that concern for those that live in the home. And when we talk to the people that are concerned, they suddenly realize that this is a great bill because we are doing as much for the pioneers as we're doing for the veterans. But it's also something that's important to the veterans, and they see it as the rights and the things that they have earned, and they say those words to me. You know, are we going to get the per diem we earned? Are we going to get the state to provide some recognition? Are we going to get the state to have a symbol of what the veterans mean to it? So for all those reasons, I would be very firmly against proceeding ahead and not changing the name. Because truly, if we educate the people, we won't ever get 100% of the people to agree to this. But when they understand what this brings to all of those that will be residents of this home, we see a very, very broad support. And it would be hard for me to go before a veterans group and say, well, you know, we're going to let you have some more access, but we're not going to add you to the name.
I appreciate your answer.
Yes. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. General, when I first came to the state in 77, one of the early things that I saw was the Pioneers Home in Anchorage, and I thought the concept was fantastic. They had to be a certain age, they had to have been in the state for a long time, and they truly were pioneers in the truest sense of the word. And then, of course, litigation changed that significantly, and it was the attitude changed. The home was still wonderful. And then about 10 to 15 years ago, somewhere in that time frame, the people living there began to change from just elderly pioneers to people with dementia, various forms of dementia, but and various stages. And I went there about 2 or 3 years ago, and it was, well, I guess I've got a weak spine, but it was truly demoralizing to see the numbers of people who were getting care. That wasn't the issue, but as you said, they sat there and they really weren't with us. Many, many, many of the inmates were inmates, wrong term, of the patients were that way. And my question to you is, and I champion your cause 100%, I can't think of enough we can do for our veterans, but if you take a healthy, aging veteran and put him in that environment, is this going to be something that he's going to appreciate, or will he think, my gosh, I'm in the halls of death here?
Through the chair to Representative Green, and I thank you also for your concern and your commitment to the veterans. The one thing I've found as we get more involved into long-term care is how they migrate to the more extreme end. And there are a couple of reasons for that, at least from my perspective, is one, we have more people in that population. But we also have a change in the way that people are looking at health care. And it's another reason why the veterans' home system is in crisis around the United States. Because it's not the home that we once envisioned or saw, with a bunch of old soldiers sitting around the chessboard and telling war stories. Because those people are choosing to stay at home as long as they can. You see a lot of initiatives in the veterans' home system to provide other ways of giving the care, and also less expensive ways to provide that care. But unfortunately, what you've just described is the process that all long-term care facilities go through. So the question is, will this meet all the needs? No, it won't. No, it won't. And the veterans that go in there, some of those veterans are functioning. But even those that you described in the situation that you described, maybe they're the ones we need to reach out to the most. Because if you look at what Dr. Cohen told us, what we have is a responsibility to help their quality of life. And the few things and the one spark that you have, and whether that's a plaque or a monument, one veteran that we had in one of the Pioneer Homes, in fact, was a former adjutant general, was very frustrated. He's a very large man. He's very frustrated about being in the home. And so working with him, they worked out a way where he was always trying to escape from the home. And They had to go and they had to bring him back into the home. But they finally figured out, well, he needs this, he needs his exercise, he needs to have the idea. And if this is the spark that this individual needs, well, they very simply made a path. It was a circular path that brought the individual back into the back door of the home every time he escaped. And it was a wonderful solution. And so even in those people of despair, which model would you take? Would you take the model that I talked to that you see in many of the other veterans' homes of the despair in the long hallway? Or would you take a model where you can make it a veterans' home and you can make them feel good about some of those long-term memories? The other thing Dr. Cohen told us is they can't remember the short-term memories, but they can remember that spark of the past. And what spark is more powerful to you than your military spark or you. You know, that is what you bring to that equation. We won't make this a home like we would all hope we would go to, the old soldier's home, but we still have just as much an obligation to provide that care and make it as good as we can for our veterans.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, General.
Mr. Chair, if I could just conclude, please. And I will make this plea one more time. If we are unsuccessful in a committee that has military and veterans in its title and its job description, you know, I don't give much hope for the rest of, you know, our prospects. Don't sit on this bill. Pass it forward. You know, don't be responsible just the right now, the six of you around the room, for stopping the action and letting the entire legislature have an opportunity to consider this. And you all know this business a lot better than I do. But I know if you don't pass this forward, it will not go forward. Thank you.
Thank you, General. Anybody else in the audience? Commissioner, do you have anything left to say? Any commission? I'll return it back to the committee then. Any committee members have any questions? Representative Murkowski.
Thank you. I had circled this question on my sheet last week. What percentage of the veterans in the home meet the 70% disability requirement? Do you have any idea?
Mr. Chairman, perhaps Mr. Cohen could best answer that question.
My name is Jim Cohn. I'm the director of Alaska Longevity Programs. There are approximately 90 veterans in the homes at the present time. Out of those 90, we know that a half a dozen of them receive monthly veteran payments because of their injuries in service. However, that group of six that we know about, the reason that we know about them is that they are on the payment assistance program, and we don't ask anybody what their income or assets or whatever is unless they're on the payment assistance program. Half the residents, if you keep up with my mathematics here, half the residents in the homes are on the payment assistance program, and so I would guess that since we know of six and that represents about half, there's probably a dozen, as many as a dozen.
Thank you.
Representative Hayes, did you have a question?
I'm not sure who to direct it to, so I support this legislation. But sitting in my last committee, I know this is going to have a very difficult time in the next committee. So, but I really don't have any objections to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know last week there was some testimony, and I've read something else that talks about what was perceived by these people as inadequate funding for this program. And I was wondering if the division would answer to, or would comment on that. Is that a possibility?
Sure.
Thank you.
The present staffing in the Pioneer Homes is based on the level of care, and we have five levels of care. So we have the coordinated services, which is the old residential, the basic assisted, and the old residential coordinated services. There's no direct care services unless in the case of an emergency. Basic assisted living level, they are sporadic services, maybe help with medications, maybe help with a bath. So it's a small amount of service. And then when you get to the enhanced, what we call enhanced assisted living, and ADRD, to explain that for a moment. The enhanced assisted living has people who tend to be a little more in need of medical help, and the ADRD people tend to be more in need of help with their dementia and have less medical problems. That's kind of the distinction we make. They need 24-hour around-the-clock help and assistance and activities and so forth. And then we have our comprehensive services, and those people usually need help with all tasks of daily living, for example, dressing, bathing, eating, walking, and moving, and so forth. Percentages of the hours of care that we provide for the residents in the enhanced assisted living, the ADRD, and the comprehensive services, approximately 4.9 hours per resident per day. Now that would mean that that the resident would have in a 24-hour period about 4.9 hours devoted to them for some reason or another. Now it might be bathing and eating, and it may be even the nurse aide, or it may be the RN on the floor that has to deal with medications or and so forth, or assessment of the resident, for example, because they're on an antibiotic. That takes some time and so forth. But all the time together, on the average, it's about 4.9 hours per resident in the 24-hour period for those levels of care. And that's pretty much system-wide. It's not just one home or the other. It's across the board. If you look at the national figures of the number of hours that are provided for nursing home patients in skilled nursing facilities in the lower 48 as an average across the country, they struggle to have 2.5 hours per resident per day. And that's documentable, no problem. And so I think we're, staffing is actually very good. I think I don't know if it was to this committee, but I mentioned it at a committee talking about staffing, that we had a lady from Chicago from the Joint Commission on Accreditation for Healthcare Organizations, and they accredit the hospitals in the United States and have for many, many years, and they're now doing accreditation for assisted living. They just started it, and we wanted to get involved in this right away because it's the Sterling accreditation for assisted living. And so she flew up from Chicago to Anchorage, and all the administrators and I met her in Anchorage to go through the program so we could get started for accreditation. In any case, we spent the day with her, and I asked her before she flew back if she would come through the Anchorage Pioneer Home, which she did. This lady has been in this type of work all her life. She's also a nurse. She immediately, we happened to come in at dinner time, and she immediately started to count staff and figure out what the staff, she told me what the staffing number was. I mean, she's very good at her job. And she said, this is very good. This is remarkable. She walked around and she looked at everything and she said, you know, down south when you have a place that looks this good, it's only the front door that looks this good, and none of the residents get to use that area. And she said, your building looks good all the way through, and it's used. It's obviously used by the residents all the way through. Nobody's putting up a front here. I think there are people who have testified. I know there are people that have testified that they don't feel that there is enough staff. Well, I'm a nurse, and I can tell you that I've worked in hospitals and long-term care, and there was never enough staff as far as I was concerned, no matter how much staff we had, because it's kind of like housework. You never kind of get it done. You never get everything done. And so you could always add more. We try to add also with volunteers and so on for activities, get an awful lot of support, as you know, around the whole state from groups. But I think that one of the perceptions that you do have that where people respond and not having enough staff is that they see, as Representative Greenwood to the Anchorage home, a lot of people there who really do have a lot of needs, and there may not be anyone standing there taking care of them at that very moment. And of course, all of us, when we see that, our heart kind of goes out to them and say, well, gee, you know, this person's here saying, help me, help me, help me, you know, or, and they might do that all day, help me, help me, help me. And you say, why isn't anybody helping them, you know? And so you get the feeling that maybe there isn't enough staff, whereas that person will sit there and that's just kind of the record that they have on because of where they are in the disease. It doesn't mean that they're not helped but or taken seriously, but on the other hand. So the other thing is that there is a nursing shortage, and people do take a look at that, and they talk to nurses, and nurses say, I've had to work, you know, my days off, I've had to work 6 days a week, so on and so forth, because we don't have enough nurses, and since they are Class 1 employees, and we need them to come in for safety reasons, we do make them come in if we can't hire someone in the position, because even though the position's empty, the work has to be done. So then you will hear from staff, we don't have enough help. And it's true, there's not enough help. They're working overtime. Doesn't mean that the residents are suffering, not having anyone there, but we need more help so people can get back to more reasonable hours. And I think that's another thing that people hear and then they reflect on, there isn't enough help. But I can tell you that, you know, I've been the director of the Pioneer Homes for 8 years, and I worked in a lot of places, and the staffing that we have is very adequate. At the same time, for the staff that are doing the work, they can't help but feel at times overworked and under-supported, because it's very difficult work.
Any other questions of the committee members? Thank you, Jim. I will return it to the committee, and I will entertain a motion. Representative Murkowski.
Mr. Chair, I would hope that this committee would move this out and recognize the comments made by General Oates, that it's certainly the purview of this committee to look at those issues as they relate to kind of the military and veteran component. I appreciate that it is going on to State Affairs, who will take a look at it, and furthermore, that Finance Committee, who will look at it from the financial perspective, which of course I think the price tag that's associated with it is of concern to folks, but I don't view that as our purview down here to make a determination that, gosh, it just looks like so much money that we should not move it. I feel very strongly that we do have an obligation to provide some kind of facility to our veterans, and it was pointed out to me when I was a chair of this committee for the past 2 years, time and time again, that this is one area where we have failed our veterans. We have ignored their very persistent requests, and the General Oates made an excellent point that, you know, veterans don't get out and whine. They have very selflessly served, and I just don't see them out pounding on the table and saying, give me this, give me this. They're very persistent when they do come around, and that's great, but you don't hear the whining, and perhaps that's why we don't have a facility for them here. I had the opportunity to speak with Secretary Principe when he was in town, and I got the very, very distinct impression that he wants to try to make something happen. He wants to try to accommodate something here. But we do have to take the first step. And I would like to think that if we can't do the full meal deal as it's proposed here, that there can be some kind of a pilot program or pilot project that we can take off. But if we lose the momentum early on, what incentive is there at the federal level to try to do anything for us? So unless other people want to put things on the record, I'm prepared to make a motion to move it out of committee. I would move that we move from committee House Bill 88 with individual recommendations in the attached fiscal note.
We have any objections? No, we'll move HB 88 out of Military and Veterans Affairs to State Affairs. With that, before we end and get out of here, our next meeting will be Tuesday, April 3rd. And the only thing we have on the agenda at this time is a confirmation hearing for Alaska Army National Guard Brigadier General Colonel Craig Noel Christensen. With that, I'd like to thank all the public members that have attended, and I'd also like to thank Laddie once again. I know I'm groveling, but hopefully you won't kill me whenever we see each other again. With that, I'll bring the meeting to a close, and once again, thank everybody.
Off, guys.